Everyone hits a bump in the road. What do you do with it? Be inspired as we explore the ways people experience, navigate, and manage the ups and downs and twists and turns in this road trip called life. Welcome to another episode of Bump in the Road. The basic podcast is always free. We also have a premium subscription called Bump 2 that lets you listen in on extended behind-the-scenes conversations with our guests. Check it out at www.bumpintheroad.us. Sophia Zilber is a data analyst in the pharmaceutical industry. She designs and analyzes large-scale projects like clinical trials. Never in a million years did she think she'd be starting a data registry because of her daughter. Sophia, welcome to Bump in the Road. If you would, tell us your story.
Thank you so much for having me here. My story is, I'm going to start. So a few years ago, almost 5 years ago, my newborn daughter died from a devastating disease called Leigh syndrome, which is a type of mitochondrial disease. And so it was a complete shock for us. She was my fourth baby. I had three kids before. I had three boys before. My oldest son was already 11 at the time. So my kids were healthy and never had any health issues, and nobody in our family had any severe disease like that or anything like that. So my pregnancy was completely normal. It was great, actually. Everything was fine. And especially, additionally, because we had three boys and I was expecting a girl, that was huge. Everyone in our family just wanted a girl for so long. My husband has a brother, so and his brother also has three boys, so we didn't have a girl in the family. And so when we found out it's a girl, we were on the top of happiness. I mean, we were so excited, and it was just unbelievable how happy we were. And when my daughter was born, she was so beautiful. She was just absolutely a perfect baby that was everything that we've dreamed of. I mean, just the minute we saw her, she was just perfect. And our family.
What was her name?
Miriam. Yeah. And we had that name picked out actually for law. Like, my husband and I picked out that name when we were still engaged. I don't know how that happened, but basically we just knew that if we have a daughter, we will name her Miriam. And so we named her Miriam, and she was just absolutely perfect. And we were so happy. Our whole family was so happy. I mean, we've got so many gifts. It was just such a happy, happy thing. And because we've never had a girl, we've been getting all these, you know, pink things and all the girly things. And my boys have been so in love with her. My oldest son was, he was taking her pictures all the time, and he was texting the pictures to his friends. And he was just so proud of having her. And, you know, my other kids would hold her every night, like when they would get home from school, and they would just want to hold her. And it's just incredible, you know, how much she was loved. And go ahead. You want to talk?
When did you find out that she had health problems?
So actually, it's interesting because even in the hospital when she was born, she wasn't feeding so well, and it was very hard. And I was an experienced mom by then, so I had three kids before, and I knew exactly how to feed a baby. And something was just off. I asked nurses to help, which I've never had to do with my other kids, but they still couldn't do it. But they gave me a feeding, a pump, you know, and all kinds of things. But they kept saying, you know, it will happen. You know, she was just born. You'll figure it out. And I remember that when I was already like packing up to leave the hospital, I was just feeling kind of overwhelmed. Something was just off. I felt very uncomfortable that I'm going home and I still can't feed my baby. And so the nurse that was kind of helping me check out, she said, well, don't worry about it. This is your fourth baby. What do you think? I mean, you'll figure it out. You know how to do this. And it's funny because she said that it made kind of, I guess, sense, but I just didn't feel good. I really didn't feel good. I didn't think that there was anything seriously wrong, but I was exhausted because I didn't sleep this whole time. I was trying to feed the baby around the clock, and I was going home with a baby that I really couldn't feed. And this is one thing I kind of, I guess, regret, that maybe I should have said, you know, can you please take her to the NICU? Can you please check her more? I think I should have done that. But again, I was very naive. I've never had to deal with anything serious. So it just didn't occur to me to do that. And so we got home and I still had issues breastfeeding. They were not getting resolved. I kept going to my pediatrician almost every day for weight checks. And I told them, look, I can't, you know, they asked me to feed her right there in the office. And I did. And they saw it's not working out. Then
what was it that wasn't working? Was she just
like, she just wouldn't suck the meat. Like she just wouldn't do it. And later on we found out that makes perfect sense because her disease makes her muscles are not working properly. So like, that's the first thing that, you know, she just can't. And so, the first days she cried a lot all the time because she was clearly hungry, and she literally cried throughout the night, much more than my other babies. She would literally, you know, scream and cry all night, and I still couldn't feed her. And then after a few days, she kind of stopped crying completely, and she became very lethargic. She would sleep a lot. She wouldn't even ask to eat. And at that point, I switched to feeding her from a bottle, but she wouldn't take, it would take me like an hour and a half to give her 2 ounces of milk or formula. And I showed that to the pediatrician. I said, look, look how she's eating. And I showed that in the office, and they said, yeah, that's kind of strange. You know, let's watch what happens. Just keep working hard on feeding her. They said, well, make sure you get help with your other kids so that all you have to feed her like all the time.
Didn't they run any tests or anything? I mean, this is what, a week or two into this and she's not feeding?
Yeah, so they didn't run any tests. They went over her newborn screening. Everything was perfect on the newborn screening. They said, no, there's nothing, you know. And then at some point I was at the doctor's office on Friday, and I said, look, there's a weekend coming up, and, you know, it's very hard. I don't know what to do. And I said, why don't I take her to Children's Hospital right now so maybe they look at her? And the doctor said, no, I mean, there's really nothing for them to check. She's okay, you know, keep feeding her. If it doesn't work out later on, you could take her for a feeding evaluation. And basically there was no serious concern at all. And then that weekend was actually the one that changed everything, because on Sunday, her hand looked a little bit puffy in a strange way. It didn't look swollen. It looked kind of like there was liquid or something inside. And so I called a doctor that was on call on Sundays, and I said, I want to bring my daughter in. Her hand looks puffy. And I didn't even know that if there was anything. I mean, I don't think I knew what that meant. I think it was just my intuition. I didn't know that there was something serious going on. I think I just felt so helpless. I just wanted to get to the doctor. And there was some intuition in me that was telling me that I should do something. And so this doctor said, yeah, why don't you come right now? And so I remember that I took her, and I, you know, it was very cold outside, and like, I just put clothes on her, like within 5 minutes. And I told my husband, can you go with me? And which I normally just, like, I wouldn't do that normally. And I don't know, 100% it was just my intuition telling me that there was some kind of a cause for alarm, because my husband and I and my baby, within a few minutes, we got into a car and we were at this doctor's office, and she looked at her and she said, "Well, you know, I need to call 911 because her breathing's off, her vital signs very low, her temperature was very low." And she was actually, then I realized that she felt her skin was very cold, and that's because her temperature was, you know, really low at that point. When she said that, I just started crying, I think. And again, I didn't know why I was crying. I still didn't think that there was something serious. I still believe that it's going to be okay.
Yeah, and the doctor didn't have any suggestions about what might be wrong. She just said, call 911.
Well, I think she just saw that it was urgent that she got to the hospital. Like, she didn't even want to talk. Like, she wanted to get it, you know, she just wanted her to be in the hospital immediately, because she told me later on that, you know, that it was almost like a miracle that when I called her, she told me to come, you know, right away. She said if she had other patients, she could have told me, you know, come in an hour, come in 2 hours. And she said at that point, you know, my daughter would have died at home within, you know, maybe half an hour or so, because how. And so when we came to the hospital on the ambulance, there was a whole team waiting for her, and they immediately put a breathing tube into her, and they told me, "We're gonna give her something to help her breathe." And I didn't even understand what they were talking about, actually. I think at that point I was just crying there, but I still didn't know there was something very serious. They put a breathing tube, they gave her a breathing tube, and then they kind of, I guess, they stabilized her. They put her in a ICU, in a NICU for babies. And then at first they were telling us that they think most likely she has an infection, and that they're going to test her for all possible infections. And they told us that they've had so many babies that came in like this with infection, like thousands of babies. And they were totally fine. I mean, infections are treatable. They would give her antibiotics. And I think they even gave her antibiotics even before they had the results back, because just in case she has an infection. And so they told us to wait. And so we were waiting and waiting and waiting. But then as time was going by, it was already like the middle of the night, and we were just waiting still, and they were telling us like each of these, you know, tests they did for different infections, it would come back negative. And like, we knew that it's already kind of, it's something, there's something else. And even the nurse told us that, you know, the longer it goes by and the longer it's not an infection, the least, you know, the less of a chance it is that it is an infection. So that's kind of, and then next day, our pediatrician came in to see her and to see us. And she told us, you know, it's not an infection. She told us it's not an infection. They don't think that anymore. She said it's a metabolic disease, but she said it's not a serious one. And I said, how do you know? She said, well, because all the serious ones, they already tested at birth. So, and we said, so what does that mean? She said, oh, don't worry about it. It'll be fine. She said, I have a child. She said, I have another patient with metabolic disease, and this child has to, you know, follow a special diet, but this child is totally fine. She definitely doesn't have anything serious.
Now, this was a cardiac problem, right?
No, Leigh syndrome is mitochondria is responsible for producing energy in the body. So when mitochondria doesn't work, the body doesn't get enough energy. So it affects every system in the body.
Gotcha.
So it's neurological, brain is affected. So when Miriam was in the hospital, they saw if she has seizures. And in baby, the seizures are not visible. So they had to do... they tested her, and they found she was having like 20 seizures an hour she was having these nonstop seizures, apparently. So her brain was very, very much affected by this disease. And her heart was actually fine, you know, at least initially, but eventually the disease took over and we knew that everything will be affected. So
how long did this take from the time you got to the hospital until you got diagnosed?
So we really already knew next day. She had MRI, and so they could see it on her brain. She had lesions on her brain that were, you know, that told them it was mitochondrial disease. And so very, very quickly. Yeah. I mean, they confirmed it later, but that they already knew that. And, you know, initially they said that she might wake up. Like she was unconscious in the hospital. She was not awake at that point. And at first they said she might be able to still wake up. But then a few days later, they did another repeat MRI. And even if within a few days, her disease progressed so much that they basically said that she's not gonna ever, you know, wake up, or you know, it's just gonna decline from then until she died.
Did you get to take her home, or what, did she stay in the hospital?
She stayed in the hospital because we wouldn't be able to, because she was you know, she was attached to the breathing, she had a breathing tube, and you know, it just made sense to keep her there. I mean, we didn't really want to. It would be too traumatic we thought it would be very traumatic for. We didn't even think about taking her home. Really, it was just very traumatic for our kids also, because you know, just the whole.
How did the boys react? And did they realize as this process was going on that their sister was this ill?
So that's a very good question. So when we learned about her disease, we needed to tell them what was going on. I mean, we didn't know what to say at first, because, I mean, just the way they loved her. I mean, it's just such a difficult thing. And so we had to tell them what's going on, because obviously they would know eventually, and they needed to know. And so we came home and we told them that Miriam is very sick. And at first they didn't really understand it. They thought we mean something like strep throat or like an ear infection. And we told them that she's very sick with something much more serious that doesn't have a treatment. And we told them right away that she might not recover. We told them that she might not get better. I mean, we just needed to tell them the truth. And so, I mean, that part was excruciating. I mean, for me as a mom, I think that was the first time ever that, you know, my kids, there was nothing I could do to fix this for them. You know, there was nothing that I could do to make this better. And I had to basically just, you know, break their heart, just tell them that something that they loved so much is getting taken away, and there's nothing, you know, that I could do to stop that. And so when we told them this, they cried so much. And again, it wasn't crying that I've ever seen before. You know, it's not like they didn't get to go somewhere or they didn't get to watch TV. This was very different. That was very deep, and it was very different. It was like I say sometimes, like they lost their innocence. They came across something where, I mean, it went against everything they knew about the world. Like they it's not something that natural that they could, you know, ever expect, and that there's nothing that can be done. Nothing can be made better. And so my middle son, he was so attached to Miriam. He used to hold her a lot, and I just remember him saying, "So I'm not going to have a sister. I'm not going to have a sister." And he said, "But how can she die? How can she be dying? I mean, How could that happen? Like, she's so small that can't happen to a baby. And, you know, it's just, they cried so much. And that first day when I told them, they literally just cried like way into the night. And
now, this was a few years ago, right?
Yeah.
So how have they reflected, have your kids reflected on this since then? And how are they kind of assimilating this experience?
So, yeah, so let me just first go back to before, and then I will.
Yeah.
My kids, so I should probably say that after I told them this initially, they kind of continued to believe that Miriam is going to recover because they're kids. And so they prayed a lot. So we are Jewish. We are pretty observant. My kids go to a Jewish day school. And so my kids, especially my oldest son, he would pray a lot pray. And they just, they really believed, you know, they believed deep inside that it's going to be okay. I mean, because, and so eventually we even talked to our rabbi and we said, you know, are we doing the right things? Kids are praying. That's really helping them. At the same time, we already know that Miriam is not going to recover. Like, what do we tell the kids? How do we? And so he advised, which I think was very smart. He advised us and he said, you know, you could tell kids that God has already made his decision for Miriam, but we still can pray, you know, for strength for our family, you know, or even for a peaceful death for her. I mean, that was okay to pray for in this situation. And so, and he talked to my kids, and I mean, I think that helped. And then, you know, when she eventually died, kids were, you know, still, when I told them that, you know, that's it, you know, she died, and they, again, like, they just cried and cried, and they said, well, they still believed that she was going to be, they were still hoping for a miracle, basically, they were still hoping, and so it was very, very difficult, and, you know, how did they reflect? I mean, it's hard to say. I think now it's hard for them to talk about it, except for, so my youngest child, he was almost 5 at that time. So he was youngest and he is the one that's more outspoken about it now. Like he will say, you know, I really miss Miriam. Or like he will take a picture and he's like, you know, I wish she was with us. Why don't we have her? Why do we not have her? And things like that. But he's more open about it. My two kids, they were older, and I think that hit them extremely hard. And so I would say they don't talk about it so much. And when we do talk about it, they just say something like, that's so sad. Like, I can't, like, they can't. Like, for example, if we go to the cemetery, you know, I asked my older kids, do you want to come? And they said, well, my oldest son said, I really can't. I'm so sad. Like, I just can't go. And so we just let them be how they want to, you know, however they want to process this is fine. I think it just really hurt them on a very deep level, you know, that, you know, yeah.
How did this experience change your life?
So changed it in many ways. I would say, so, I mean, I personally, just like I say, my kids lost their innocence. I think I also lost my innocence in a way. I think I just never, ever imagined that something like that could happen to me. I mean, when you read things in the news, there are tragedies and everything, and we always feel bad, but you just don't imagine. And especially, you know, there was really no warning signs. And so I think I myself felt kind of almost like my life started all over, like almost like everything I knew about the world has like shattered. And I almost like had to start over in a way, like just what I know about the world. Like, I don't know, it just wasn't, it was so shocking and something that just I could never see coming. And so in a way, I myself feel like I was kind of like born all over again, you could say. So I definitely tried. I mean, at first I was just, I just had a few months or like a long time when I was just, when I just had these waves of grief. I mean, it was just very, like, I don't know, I had nightmares. I just was very difficult for a while. But then I tried to redirect it into doing things in Miriam's memory, where I felt like I could make a difference because of this experience. And so so professionally I work in the pharmaceutical industry. And so I was able to, so I work in clinical trials in statistical analysis and programming. And so I was able to use my knowledge of data and my knowledge of data analysis to help, which I would say, speaking of a bump on the road, I guess it wasn't a totally smooth road either, because I have always worked in the industry and I've always worked with data for clinical trials, and I've never worked with nonprofits or, you know, patient advocacy groups. I didn't even know that patient advocacy groups could collect data from patients. I just, the way I thought about the data was very different. And I think it took me some time to, well, I had a big learning curve there as well, I think.
No, did you work with a not-for-profit group? Did you found one? Talk a little bit about the logistics of that.
Yeah. So, initially, I worked with a group where I did data analysis of a patient registry, and I was able to publish a paper on it, which, you know, I think that paper is very meaningful. It gave a lot of attention to the patient's perspectives and patient's quotes, and I was able to kind of take these quotes that patients have written, and they wanted these quotes to be read, and they wanted to be heard. And I was able to, you know, through this paper, I was able to bring that out. But overall, that first project was, it didn't quite work out as I hoped, just due to, again, the things that exist in nonprofits and others, that things don't go always, you know, very smoothly. But eventually, right now, I do have a very, very meaningful role in mitochondrial disease community. I'm a board member with the Cure Mito Foundation, and that foundation is a parent-led foundation. It's very small. It's led by a few families. It's a fully volunteer foundation, so nobody's getting a salary, but everyone's extremely dedicated, and it's truly there for the right reasons. It's truly there to help the kids and to help families. And so I created a patient registry with that foundation, and it's specifically for Leigh syndrome. It's the disease that my daughter had, and that's the focus of the Cure Mito Foundation. And so our registry is global. It's for everyone in the world. And we started it last September, and we already have over 160 patients who joined. Wow. from over 20, I think it's 23 countries now. I mean, we reached out so far. This week, somebody joined from Ecuador. I mean, it's amazing how far in the world we've been able to reach out with this registry.
How prevalent is this disease? And is it only in newborns?
It's not only in newborns. I mean, it usually shows up in an infant or a very small child. In some cases, it could start later as well. I believe the prevalence is about 1 in 77,000, although I don't know if that's 100% accurate because I've seen other numbers for it. Yeah.
You know, I interviewed somebody who lost his daughter, and one of the things that was a turning point for him was he said, rather than why did this happen to me, why did this happen for me?
That's a good statement. I mean, that's kind of where I'm trying to think, you know, thinking if that happened to me, there must be a purpose to it. It didn't just happen. I mean, I don't believe that it's a random thing that just happened. I believe that there is a purpose to everything that we go through in life. And if that happened, there must be a purpose and there must be a reason that it happened specifically to me. And so that's kind of how I try to think about it, you know, just going forward.
What have you learned along the way? And what would you pass on to other parents potentially facing this sort of situation?
That's a good question. I think I've learned many things along the way. I don't even know. I think just thinking where to start. Oh, sorry, one second.
No, it's a really hard question. Because I think that when we hit a bump like this where there's so much grief, so much deep grief, I don't know that we ever fully process it, to tell you the truth. But as we're processing it, it's very hard to get perspective on it.
Right. I mean, I think I've learned that I'm stronger than I thought. I mean, that's one thing I've learned. I've changed a lot. I've learned to be more brave. I've learned to be more assertive. I've learned that, you know, we don't know what's going to happen to any of us tomorrow or next hour or next minute. And so if there's something we want to do or something that's important to us, we should go and do it because we don't know if we're going to have another chance or another opportunity. You know, I've learned that, again, if there's something you need to say or something that's important to speak up, you need to speak up. I mean, I guess this just gave me more courage in my life, you know, just gave me more courage to make decisions that I need to make in every, you know, in every area of life. I think in my experience with the patient registry specifically, I just wanted to talk about it a little bit separately because that is a big part of what I do now. It's interesting because I'm in this very strange role because on one hand, I'm a professional and I have many years of experience with data, with clinical trials where data has to be very high quality, you know, and I just know, like, I'm coming into the space where there's nonprofits and patient advocacy groups that are collecting patient data where they just don't have that perspective. And in many cases, there's data collected for years and it's just kind of sitting there. There's nothing really done with it. And so I think, sorry, one second.
What do you hope to find in the data? Do you have any expectations?
I think one thing I'm hoping is just to bring that. One thing I'm hoping is just to kind of that my knowledge will change not only, you know, my registry, but even, you know, this field. I think we need to. I think patients, when they sign up for these various registries, they have a lot of hope. And a lot of times they are told, you know, if you join this, we will find a cure. And I think one thing that I am always trying to emphasize is that I want patients to be more educated. I want patients to be more informed. Like, they should ask questions. What is done with my data? You know, will I be getting results? How is this data shared with other researchers? How is this data shared with other companies? When can I expect to see results of this data? How is this data you know, if they're filling out the service, who designed this service? Who provided input into them? How is it, you know, how much transparency is there about how data is shared?
What is the goal of this particular data gathering operation?
So for us, the goal, so there are many goals, but one very important goal is to help clinical trial efforts, because clinical trial recruitment is in rare diseases very difficult because there are very few patients. They are all over the world. We don't always know where they are. And so bringing them together in one place where it's easy to contact them, mm-hmm. and it's easy to look them up. Let's say if a company is looking patients with a specific genetic mutation or specific symptom, just having that all in one place, that's a huge help. And I can already see, we just had this register for a few months, but when we speak to, you know, the pharmaceutical companies who run clinical trials, they ask us, do you have this? Do you have that? And we can quickly give them that information. And so they're finding that really, really helpful. So just that alone is a big, big help, just having all these patients together. It helps, you know, raise awareness of this disease again. And the fact that we collect this data and we share the findings, so we just had a poster presented at a conference, and now we're working on a paper that's going to be published in the medical journal, and it's going to have a lot more details. And the poster is already available. So, you know, just sharing these results, first of all, it really helps the patients to see that, well, they took the time. They filled out these surveys, and then and now they can see how it's helping. They can see the actual results. They can see how their data contributed. And we're trying to explain to a patient that that's important. Whatever study they sign up to, they should ask if that will be the case. So that's a huge help. We also the registry is also helping, you know, learn about the disease, because we could see from how patients answer questions how it's affecting them, you know, what a part of their life or what, you know, what symptoms are most prevalent. So that's really important to just to learn, because the disease is not well understood yet. So that's very important. And I mean, I think a big part that I always try to emphasize is it makes our patient community stronger, because we're all joining in. And, you know, we always tell patients that it's not like we are doing this registry. We are all doing this registry with them. And so I think that makes our community stronger. Patients participate, and we have families that partner with us, and they also help us. They help us share the registry with other patients. We have families, you know, are internationally, and they can share in their own language, in their own country. And that's how we make connections, and we spread out, you know, around the world. So now our registry surveys are translated to Spanish, to Portuguese, because we already have enough patients in these other countries where they needed this. And, you know, we hope to do more languages later on. And so, so it's a lot of goals, but it's, you know, it's all very positive.
That's really amazing. I'm incredibly impressed, particularly with the growth of everything. What if you could give some advice to parents facing this, what would you tell them?
I would tell them that there might be a lot of hard times, and there might be a lot of setbacks. It's not a smooth process. It's not like this happens and then next day you're a little bit better and next day you're a little bit better. It's not like that. There's a lot of setbacks. It's hard. It's hard, but I would say that you need to believe that you exist for a reason. You exist for a reason. You're not just, you know, you matter. Like, that's what I would, your experience matter. You matter. Your children, your family, you all matter. And what happens to you matters. And so just there is a purpose, and just you will see it. Not right away. And I'm not saying I see it now. It's, again, it's not a quick, you know, thing, but there is a purpose, and it matters. And you're on this path, and you're making a difference in whatever you're going through. You are helping others with however you're doing it. And just know that, you know, you're not just a victim here. You are strong, and you can do this, and you can help others, and you can make a big change.
Thank you for joining us today. I hope you found something in today's podcast that inspires you along your own life's path. because sometimes a bump in the road is actually a portal into a more conscious and meaningful life. You can subscribe to our free podcast at www.bumpintheroad.us or become a premium member to hear the full conversation. Just go to www.bumpintheroad.us for more information and to sign up.